On the show today, more drones headed towards Moscow.
Moscow's mayor says the drones were intercepted on their approach to the capital and there were no casualties.
Plus, the Russian military prepares to build up its forces along its western border.
Threats to the military security of the Russian Federation have multiplied in the strategic western and northwestern directions.
And later in the program, a look back at the controversial re-election of Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus on its third anniversary. Today is Wednesday, August 9th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. August 9th is the third anniversary of Alexander Lukashenko's controversial re-election. We'll have that story in a bit. We begin today, though, with the story of another drone attack deep inside Russian territory. Russian officials say air defenses shot down two drones overnight aimed at Moscow. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
Officials say it was Ukraine's latest attempt to strike the Russian capital in an apparent campaign to unnerve Muscovites and take the war to Russia. Moscow's mayor says the drones were intercepted on their approach to the capital and there were no casualties. He says one of the drones came down south of the city and the other fell near the Minsk highway west of the city. It was not clear where the drones were launched from, and Ukrainian officials have not commented so far. Ukraine usually neither confirms nor denies such attacks. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, a blast rocked an optics and optical electronics factory in the town of Sergeyev Prosad, about 50 kilometers northeast of Moscow, injuring at least 45 people. Emergency services said the blast appeared to have occurred in a warehouse containing pyrotechnic equipment. Footage on social media showed a huge column of thick smoke and high-rise buildings with windows blown out. The factory produces optical equipment for industrial and healthcare applications, as well as for the Russian security forces. Russian state media agency TASS, citing emergency services, said they did not believe the blast had been caused by a Ukrainian drone attack. Russia sees its own threat level increasing and will build up its military forces near its western borders now that Finland is part of NATO. This according to Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, speaking to the governing board of the Ministry of Defense on Wednesday.
Threats to the military security of the Russian Federation have multiplied in the strategic western and northwestern directions. A serious destabilizing factor is Finland joining NATO, and in the future, Sweden too. After Helsinki joined the alliance, Russia's land border with the bloc's countries almost doubled. On Finnish territory, it is likely that additional NATO military contingents and strike weapons will be deployed, capable of hitting critical targets in the northwest of Russia at a considerable depth.
Shoigu said that NATO member Poland had already announced plans to strengthen its military.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced its intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent. In this regard, large-scale purchases of weapons have begun from the United States of America, Great Britain, and the Republic of Korea, including tanks, artillery systems, air defense, and missile defense systems and combat aircraft.
Shoigu added that these threats to Russia's military security require a timely, adequate response. Another drone attack in Moscow and a huge explosion at a factory that produces electronic equipment for the Russian military. We get the latest from VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief, Miroslava Gongadze. Miroslava, another drone attack against Moscow early on Wednesday. Ukrainian authorities are not saying anything. Moscow blames Kyiv. What are you hearing?
Kyiv is quiet about their abilities actually attack Russia. However, Kyiv never took responsibility for any of so-called incidents in Russia. Experts, though, believe it is the work of Ukrainian counterintelligence to destroy Kremlin ability to fight and show Russian population and Russian leadership and military that with the war in Ukraine, they are not safe in Russia and they have to stop this war. That's what that is the belief in the expert community.
Now, in addition to the drone attack in Moscow, there was also a very large explosion at a factory that produces optical electronic equipment, both for industry and for the military. What are you hearing from there?
According to Russian media, the explosion occurred at the Zagorsk Optical and Mechanical Plant in the town of Serhiyev Posad. This is one of the oldest optical mechanical plants. It produces optical aviation sites, thermal direction founders, target seekers, laser detection stations, observation devices, as well as night vision devices. Why it's important? Because all these devices and all this equipment is directly feeding the war in Ukraine. In the summer of 2022, a large fire reportedly broke out at the same factory storage facility. Russian state-controlled news outlets TASS claimed the source of the explosion was caused by human error and originated in a pyrotechnical warehouse rented by third company on the side of the plant. The local mayor office right now reported that the number of people injured in the explosion has risen from 31 to 45 people, and 23 of them have been admitted to hospital and seek and six of them are in intensive care.
Now, you mentioned that TASS is saying that it appears to be an accident. Is there any indication, any rumor that that's not true?
Kremlin is not saying any more of that. They don't want to admit that Ukraine can actually target them in on their territory. And Ukrainians are not admitting that they did something like that or they are capable of doing something like that. But the rumors are around that definitely that it's a Ukrainian work.
Now, let me ask another question. If anything bad happened in Moscow, would it be in Ukraine's best interest, in their favor, to sow the seeds that it was their doing, to make those rumors?
Ukrainians have a challenging counteroffensive operation right now. And it's a very difficult for them to make progress on a battlefield. So possibly this is one of the way Ukrainians are trying to show or their ability at least to strike Russians in Russia, at least using the capability they have without Western weapons. So it's a probably more attack on it, like a psychological attack on Russia and Russian military, but as well as possibly destroy their ability to fight. Or there were a lot of fires in Russia lately, and they all happened in the facilities that this or other way feed the war in Ukraine.
Miroslava Gongadze in Warsaw. Miroslava, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. The anniversary of Lukashenko's re-election in Belarus coming up in a moment. Now we look at another aspect of Belarusian politics. It's no secret that drones have played a very important role in this war for both sides. Russia has been getting many of its drones from Iran, and now there's concern that Belarus might follow. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with James Rogers. He's executive director of the Cornell Brooks School Tech Policy Institute about why Iran is seeing a recent surge in demand for its drones from other nations, including Belarus.
The demand for Iranian drones is growing at a record rate, and this is something that is happening globally. It's not just an Iranian phenomenon. Any nation that has seen itself pivot its industry towards the production of drones is seeing a massive increase in demand for those systems. So we can only need to think about Turkey or, of course, Iran as a key example. But there's also China as well that produces a large array of drone systems. And as I said to the United Nations Security Council back in August, it's at this point we're starting to worry about the current state and future state of international security. Because by our last calculations, and I've been discussing this with colleagues, we think that around 113 different nation states have access to military drone technologies or have a military drone program. And that's just the nation states. We believe that at least, at the very least, 65 non-state actor groups, violent non-state actor groups, have access to these systems as well. So this is the proliferation of violent air power globally.
What is making Iranian drones particularly appealing to countries like Bolivia and maybe even Belarus?
It's a great question, Michael, and it's one that's steeped in history. It goes back to the 1980s. So Iran, after the Shah is deposed, is left with these big ticket high-tech items of manned air power, piloted aircraft, and big tanks. But with the withdrawal of Western support for these systems and technical support, they're pretty much useless, and any pilot that could fly away did. And so Iran is left in a very difficult situation. It quickly gets embroiled in the Iran-Iraq war, and it needs to have the capacity to be able to fight that war. And so from very early on in the early 80s, Iran turns towards these cheaper, easier to manufacture, easy to use systems that will give them a rudimentary, albeit powerful, air power capability. And this is where the drones are born. So Iran isn't new to this game. They've been developing drones for decades. Now, of course, skip to the current day, and we can see that Iranian drones are having a massive impact on the war in Ukraine, in Russia's offensive war against Ukraine. And this war has acted as a shop window for Iran, showing just how powerful its Shahed 136 and Shahed 131 loitering munitions can be in terms of fulfilling Russian military aims. And so this is exactly why other countries want to buy Iranian drones, because they believe they are effective systems and they want to get a slice of that pie.
And now apparently Russia's ally Belarus is interested in having Iranian drones produced on its territory. If you consider the latest research from the Institute for the Study of War, Belarus hasn't come out and said officially that, yes, we want Iranians to come in and start building drones here. But what do you think is the reality in terms of Belarus's relationship with Iran?
Well, there's two points to make here. First of all, there is an element of a relationship between Belarus and Iran, because it's these Iranian drones that are being launched, we believe, from Belarus into Ukraine. And so that largely likely means that there are Iranian personnel either training Russian operatives who are operating out of Belarus, so they could well be in Belarus themselves, or they're stationed further back and they're in Russia and they're training from somewhere like Crimea, let's say. Either way, we can see that there's already a direct link between these Iranian military systems and Belarus. Now, one problem that Russia has had is making sure that there are secure supply lines of these Iranian drones being sent to Russia. They need hundreds, if not thousands, of them. This has got incredibly difficult because the US has put in very stringent, very strict, and heavily enforced trade embargoes on Russia from Iran. And so how do you get around this? Well, one of the options is to build a drone factory, a Shahed 136 loitering munition factory, especially for that system, in Belarus, and then you can make the drones exactly where you're firing from. You're reducing that distance from the tail of your logistics to the teeth of your firepower. And that's exactly what Russia is going to want to do if it wants to make gains in the war against Ukraine.
That's Michael Lippin, host of Flashpoint Iran, here on VOA, speaking with James Rogers of the Cornell Brooks School Tech Policy Institute. August 9th is the third anniversary of the re-election of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko in an election that is widely seen as fraudulent and stolen. I speak with Katie LaRoque, Deputy Director for Policy and Advocacy for Freedom House.
You know, August 9th is an important day for Belarus and for democratic movements around the world. It's a somber anniversary, but it's also a day of immense hope. 3 years ago, the 2020 elections in Belarus were blatantly stolen by Alexander Lukashenko. There's ample evidence to suggest that the democratic opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, rightfully won. And upon seeing this and upon seeing the regime crack down on peaceful protesters, what happened was we saw a nationwide peaceful democratic uprising and movement that took place. Hundreds of thousands of Belarusians took to the streets demanding change and a better future in Belarus.
Now, we're in a situation here in the United States where somebody is saying that an election was blatantly stolen, and that person has just been indicted on multiple federal charges. How do we know the election in Belarus was, in fact, fraudulent?
In this case, I can't speak to what happened in the United States, but in this case for Belarus, we know from the polling stations overseas, there were exit polls that did indicate overwhelming support for Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. And within Belarus, we know from domestic monitors and different civil society groups that indeed Tikhanovskaya did win. There was blatant fabrication, and the tabulation of results just seemed ridiculous based on what we could verify. And I think it's important to note that the Belarusian people responded peacefully. They took to the streets, as I said, and what was unfortunate, you know, the reason why August 9th is indeed a somber day is because the Lukashenko regime responded with arguably the largest violent crackdown on innocent civilians in modern Belarusian history.
And what's been the state of the Belarusian opposition since then?
They're thriving, albeit in exile. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of Belarusians were forced to flee Belarus for their safety. Many are now residing in Europe, in the Baltic states. But they continue their efforts. They would rather be in Belarus, but they had to flee for their safety, as I say. They are engaged in a number of important endeavors. They're arguably essential to preserving Belarusian national identity, language, and culture. And they've been instrumental, frankly, in documenting the human rights abuses of the Lukashenko regime. Viesna, a famous human rights organization that's highly reputable, every day reports on the number of political prisoners in Belarus. This morning alone, I double-checked the statistic. It's 1,494 unjustly detained Belarusians. They're an essential voice, and they have been calling for greater attention on what's happening in Belarus, but also for accountability.
It's well established that Lukashenko is a close ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is there any evidence that Putin is helping Lukashenko in his crackdown?
Absolutely. The two of them are jointly working together and collaborating. And I think, you know, to zoom out a little bit, one thing that we think is important to stress on this day of August 9th is that Lukashenko is as much an enabler of Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine as he is an accomplice. The two depend on each other, and we're seeing not only Lukashenko's repression affect the Belarusian people with the support of Putin, we're now also seeing that impact innocent Ukrainian civilians, and that's worth calling attention to.
Well, tell us how it's affecting the Ukrainians, please.
Well, I think the blood of innocent Ukrainian civilians is as much on Lukashenko's hands as it is on Putin's, right? We saw a little more than a year ago that Lukashenko allowed Russian troops to stage their initial assault on Kyiv. Belarusian territory continues to be the source of missile strikes on civilian populations across Ukraine. And now we've seen more recent reporting, including from RFERL, that Belarus, specifically the Lukashenko regime, is playing a role in the systematic deportation of Ukrainian children, which is a war crime, almost certainly, and considered an act of genocide enumerated under the UN Genocide Convention.
Katie LaRocque is Deputy Director for Policy and Advocacy at Freedom House. We reached her in Washington, D.C. Ms. LaRocque, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
At least one local bookstore in Washington says people want to read more Ukrainian books. Such interest rose dramatically after the start of Russia's invasion and hasn't faded. Irina Shankarenko has the story, narrated for us by Anna Rice.
This one, Lucky Breaks, Yevgenia Belarusets. It's a very new short story collection, and it's very popular.
Leland Fowler with Kramer's Bookstore in the heart of Washington, D.C., proudly shows one of the latest store arrivals, the English translation of a book by Ukrainian photographer and writer Yevgenia Belarusets, telling the stories of Ukrainians after Russia's invasion. There are many more titles like this, a myriad of books by Ukrainian authors translated into English.
For the past year, there's been a lot more interest in Ukrainian authors. We have one book that is an anthology of fiction written by Ukrainians, and that is very popular because people are just interested in what life is like there.
Fowler is head book buyer at Kramer's, and she says there are a few authors whose books keep going out of stock. One of them is Ukrainian historian Serhiy Plohy.
They really wanted to know about the background, so they bought The Gates of Europe a lot to know the background of the relationship between the two countries.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, Kramer's had a special display dedicated to the war. As a result, the store managers like Andrew Jones say books about Russia's history and Putin have also been popular lately.
We made a display of Ukrainian history books as well as many Russian history books, specifically ones that kind of focus on that cultural personality of Putin. And it sold very well for about 3 months.
Fowler says before the war, the store wasn't selling books by Ukrainian authors at all. Today, however, they pay close attention to the authors they pick.
Before the invasion, I didn't think about where an author was from, Russia or Ukraine. Didn't think about nationality, just thought about the book. Afterwards, I started thinking about the nationality because I knew that that was going to be of interest to my customers.
As a result, Ukrainian authors have gained access to a relatively closed U.S. book market, says Oleg Katsuba with the Harvard University's Ukrainian Research Institute.
First of all, until recently, people knew very little about Ukraine. They didn't know Ukraine has a rich and diverse culture, literature, books, etc. On top of that, the Ukrainian government hasn't done much to popularize Ukrainian writers and Ukrainian literature. Only recently there's been work done to change that.
It's unclear if the popularity of Ukrainian authors translates outside of the diplomatic and political hub of Washington, D.C. But at least here, Americans want to know more about the country that continues to defy a Russian invasion. For Irina Shankarenko and Irina Matveichuk in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.